guest this hour is Ben Yagoda. He's a professor of English, journalism, and writing at the University of Delaware. And we're mulling this hour the internet and the way that it has changed the way we think, read, and write. We'll try to get a handle on what all that texting, tweeting, and emailing has done as to the way we express ourselves with the written word. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm glad to be with you this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And Ben Yagoda has a forthcoming book. It's called How to Not Write Bad. And he's also the author of When You Catch an Adjective, Kill It. And we're looking forward to hearing from you this hour. What do you think of the runaway exclamation points that we see online today, or the haphazard commas and the other wobbly punctuation? You can call us with your questions and pet peeves at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send your email to talk@WPR.org. You can also chime in on our Facebook page at The Veronica Rickert Show. And Ben Yagoda, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Well, the internet is a hot spot to look at how language is evolving. And as a lover of language and a stickler for the rules, what are you seeing?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure I quite accept the stickler term. That brings to mind some crotchety person correcting everybody right and left. I'm a little bit in the middle because, as you mentioned, I'm a teacher, and when I teach writing, it's journalism and other kinds of writing for publications. So whether you call them rules or conventions or whatever, there are certain things that, yes, in that context, I am a stickler. But then when I take off my professor hat, you know, that mortarboard or whatever it is, and fling it on the floor, and then am a reader and citizen of, you know, letters and the internet, I'm much less a stickler. I guess I'm more of an observer, an interested observer in how people use language. So after that long-winded defense or apology, I forgot the question.
I was wondering what you were seeing on the internet in terms of the way that language is evolving.
Oh, right. Well, the internet, it's to use a cliche, and it's hard to avoid, it's a game changer. It is a phenomenon the likes of which, in terms of language, I've never experienced in my lifetime. I guess one thing that comes to mind initially is that more people are writing more word sentences than probably ever before in history. I mean, people bemoan the loss of letter writing. I'm not sure how many people ever really wrote letters. Even back in those days, I didn't write or get that many. But so many people are out there emailing, texting, tweeting, writing Facebook updates, that it's, you know, that in itself to me is heartening, that people are writing. And a remarkable number of them, it seems to me, write well in the sense, not so much of these rules that I was talking about, but expressively, pointedly, personally, with humor, style, flair, all those things. So I kind of observe and blogs, I didn't mention those. I observe these things often with a kind of happy amazement and surprise that so many people are writing so well.
One thing I noticed in all of that writing you're talking about is that it seems as though the rules, as we might have learned them in grammar school, have become softer. It's almost anything goes when it comes, you know, to punctuation. It's optional. It becomes the punctuation and the way that we use grammar to a certain extent, it can become more a means of self-expression rather than an observation of rules.
Well, I think you're right. I think especially in terms of punctuation. I mean, one particular thing that I've written about is what is referred to as logical punctuation, which essentially means it's in reference to, and I won't get technical, but just using periods and commas in relation to quotation marks. So if I said, his nickname is, quote, Tiny, quote, where do I put that period? Do I put it inside the quote, the second quotation mark after tiny, or outside? Now, the traditional rules, as we use them in the United States, and of course, Great Britain is different, but the traditional rules are to put it inside the quotation mark. So, quotation mark, tiny, period, quotation mark. Now, that, in for reasons that is probably too long and technical and boring to get into, it doesn't really make sense. And people bristle at that. And in fact, among the community of linguists and grammarians, for some years, they have decreed that in their journals that people put the period outside the quotation marks. But they're pretty much the only ones of established organizations in the United States. So if the Associated Press, the New York Times, the New Yorker, all the major publishers follow the rule, the traditional rule of putting the period inside the quotation marks, on the Internet, all bets are off. People more often than not put the period outside the quotation marks because it makes sense. So, you know, what you were saying, they don't really follow the rules or follow them only to the extent they feel it makes sense. And that's one example of that.
And another, and you wrote a long blog post about this recently, is the exclamation point, which is sort of a fun one because it's such an expressive one, but it seems as though exclamation points are running amok right now.
They are.
They're having a field day.
It's exclamation point inflation. That is, it was one time when you would kind of, you know, pull one out if you really wanted to emphasize, I hate you, exclamation point. Well, nowadays, with this inflation, that one exclamation point has the weight of a period, so it has to be two or even three or four. And some people, and this is really something you could see a lot in the texting and the tweeting, for some reason. But people who are adept at these forms, and you know they are forms like others, are very expressive. So they might use one to mean a certain level of emotion or feeling, or three to mean another. They might combine exclamation points and question marks. So it would be the exclamation point, question mark to indicate enthusiasm, but a bit of a question. So it's a very elaborate sort of system of communication. And of course, that's what writing is all about, is communicating. So people are using these tools in new ways.
Well, one of the things you suggest is that because this sort of writing can be dull and you're not looking at something, you're not communicating face-to-face, you know, you need to pile on the exclamation points, right, to even bring it up to sort of a dull level of interest. Whereas, you know, in a different means of communication, it would be obvious. So, you know, and it does seem... It used to be an exclamation point was kind of a precious thing. You know, it meant something. If someone used one of those, one of their stock, it was a big deal. And now, you know, you see texts all the time with maybe five exclamation points on
them.
Right.
And there's a bit of a backlash to that, I think. And a lot of people rightly mock it. And I don't mean to say that this is all good. You know, as you say, if you and I mean, you and I are talking on the phone, so I don't know if you're, you know, dozing off or looking out the window or whatever as you listen to me, and you don't know whether I'm, you know, winking or smiling or whatever those cues are as I'm talking. Now, but it's always been the case that in the written word, whether it's a letter or an article or an essay or a novel, that the writer has to supply those things that aren't available in those face-to-face communications. And you could argue, and I think with some justice, that some of those skills, those writing skills of giving those giving that emotional content with either punctuation or figures of speech or irony or whatever, have fallen by the wayside a little bit. And people are in a hurry, and they're not careful writers the way a Samuel Johnson or a John Updike was to name two great stylists of yore. So they kind of go the easy route with this punctuation and excessive exclamation points. So it's not all a good thing by any means.
Some of the cultural rules that you turned up were pretty interesting. You came across a teenager who said that you should never use two exclamation points. It was either one or it was three.
Right, right. That's that very elaborate thing. And, you know, my own daughter, who's soon to be 22, the texting is something that skews younger, and people of my age, and I'm not sure how old you are, but it's something that I'm kind of not hugely comfortable with. I see the appeal and the function of it. So I would text my daughter back and forth, and she'd say, I'll be on the bus coming home, and I'd write, good, I'll see you there, period. Dad, you cannot put a period in a text. Why not? It's a sentence. I put a period. You know, it's not like it's costing me any, you know, minutes or money in my plan to use. And he said, no, it looks like you're being sarcastic.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So I'm old enough to use a period in my text,
sure.
Too.
So I guess her thought is either use nothing or an exclamation point. If it's nothing, that's just a plain, straightforward statement. One exclamation point is a certain degree of enthusiasm. And if great, I'll be there, I think she would have wanted an exclamation point. But something just more neutral, she would want nothing. And this young person, my friend's daughter that I quote in the article, seemed to feel that the one, I didn't get an explanation, but that the one exclamation point is that normal kind of general enthusiasm. Three is special enthusiasm. The two is kind of in between and doesn't really mean anything. So in her circle, and I don't know how widespread that is, maybe some of your listeners have experienced that, the two is just something you don't do.
You know, it was also interesting, going back to the use of the period in texting, that the Obama slogan has been criticized. I can't remember who criticized it, but for using a period, that it was forward, period.
Right.
Which made it sort of sound like forward, but stop.
Yeah, stop. And it sounds a little ironic. There's a current band, a rock band. I think they might be called Fun. Again, correct me if I'm wrong. I saw them interviewed by Stephen Colbert. But their band name is, I believe it's Fun or whatever the word is, period. And it's like, what? Why? What is this? Is it ironic? Is it what's going on? So it, you know, punctuation does have these emotional or subtle shades of meaning, and you can be an artist or a craftsperson with it, as well as, you know, using it in an unthinking way.
So does that bleed over into the papers that you're seeing turned in as an English professor? Does, you know, these excessive exclamation
right.
points and the wandering periods, do they show up in print?
You know, no. That's my one-word answer, and it's interesting. And you see, when you read art, as I read a lot of articles bemoaning the state of writing today and students today and so forth, and often they'll make that point that people write as if they're texting with, like, LOL and things. I've never seen one of those abbreviations. I've been teaching for 20-plus years. I've never seen any sort of acronym or abbreviation. I've never seen, that I can recall, more than one exclamation point. I mean, usually if they have even one, I say that's not appropriate for this paper. But these things don't bleed over. One thing I do see is a lack of you know, great knowledge about the rules and conventions of punctuation and also of spelling. The spelling thing is, you know, two things. One is, I think people have come to rely on spell check, which doesn't help in some cases where there are two words that are both words, they're spelled different ways, and it won't say that the wrong word is wrong. So over the course of recent years, the verb to lead, like to lead a group or lead a party, the past tense of that, he led the group, is L-E-D, But the majority of students I have write LEAD, which is a word that means a certain kind of metal. And for some reason, they want to have that be the past tense, and spell check doesn't correct them. So, and in addition to spell check programs, to me, a cause for these issues with punctuation and spelling, and also proper word use, where they'll reach for a word and it's not really the right word. I think maybe they're just going through the thesaurus and saying, oh, that's, I used this one a sentence ago, so let me use this one. That's good. And it's not really the same. I think that that comes from not doing very much reading, reading of books, articles, edited text. And when you read a lot like that, generally you absorb and you learn the rules. And I think that's one of the things that's going on today as well.
People aren't getting exposure to copy-edited prose, it sounds like.
Right. I think that to the extent they read blogs and Facebook updates and tweets, and especially the latter two aren't written. They're certainly not edited, and they're generally not written according to these rules and conventions that are required if you're writing for publication or if you're writing in a business environment. So often when I get students there, they don't have enough of a knowledge of those conventions and rules.
Well, we're talking this hour with Ben Yagoda, professor of English, and he also has a blog about writing on the New York Times. It's called Draft, and his forthcoming book is called How to Not Write Bad. This hour, we're talking about the way that the internet has changed the way that we write, looking at some of those conventions for online writing, for tweeting, for texting, and some of the ways that that might be shifting the way that we write when it's in a more formal setting. And looking forward to hearing some of your pet peeves and your questions, maybe just your observations about what's going on out there online at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we talk about the way that the internet is changing the way that we write, both online and on paper. And our guest is Ben Yagoda, professor of English journalism and writing at the University of Delaware. He's got a new book coming out in February, I think it is, and that book will be called How to Not Write Bad. And let's take our first phone call right now. We've got Camille joining us from Frankfort, Michigan. Hi, Camille.
Hi. I've been a proofreader and editor for a long time, way before personal computers and internet and all that stuff. And we discovered that after we started doing editing for online websites and people started doing lots of emailing and things like that, that there were some big problems with the fact that a lot of fonts don't, the punctuation doesn't show up very well on the screen versus when you're reading a piece of paper. And we found that in some cases we would adjust some ways that we would use punctuation. For example, commas often don't show up very well. And so there are, especially because when people are writing online, writing emails and things like that, it tends to be a little bit more conversational than actual writing style, formal writing style. So sometimes you can tweak the punctuation that you use a little bit in order to make it more readable, to make it clear what is being said. And I think that may have a lot to do with some of these changes people are making on their own. They're you know, it just doesn't look the same. And the thing with the exclamation points, especially if the last letter, like if you're saying, what the hell, exclamation point, you can't even see it. It looks like another L.
Looks like an L, right.
And and if the last letter is a more or less upright letter, like a D or something like that, that kind of thing happens. And so I think, I don't know how much of it is happening naturally or what, but we find that we have to intentionally tweak what we do in order to make it more readable.
Right. And you know, when you talk about conversational, that's so true. And when I was talking before about some of the good writing you see on the internet and blogs, it's really a sort of new frontier in excellent conversational writing. It's a mix between good talking and good writing. But in terms of conversational punctuation, there are trends in punctuation over time, so that when I was a kid, the trend was to use more punctuation, especially more commas. So you'd have a sentence, yesterday President Obama gave a speech or something like that, and you would put a comma after yesterday. And correct me if you disagree, but I think over time the copywriting trends have been to use fewer commas. So now we would tend to say yesterday he gave a speech, no comma after yesterday, which in a way makes it more conversational with the commas. It slows it down and makes it more literary without more conversational.
I think I've seen that. Camille, do you see the fewer commas thing?
Yes, I do. Not only that, but then you get writers like the author of Angela's Ashes, where it's all conversational. I mean, there's nothing, almost nothing in there except what you absolutely have to do. And a lot of writers are going more toward this bare bones kind of punctuation.
Right, and Frank McCord in Angela's Ashes, following James Joyce in Ulysses, I think, didn't use quotation marks for the dialogue. I think he might have used dashes, but no quotation marks, which is and Cormac McCarthy, I think, does the same thing. So these creative writers, you know, Samuel Beckett was the master of what we call the comma splice, which is using a comma instead of a period to separate clauses. Hmm. Among the so-called creative writers, there's always been a lot more leeway. And you could look at these online writers as sort of saying, hey, we can experiment around too, just like Samuel Beckett did.
Well, thanks so much for the call, Camille. Appreciate it. And we move next to Teresa in Green Bay. Hey, Teresa.
Hi. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure.
I want to say I don't think it's as bad as you may think. I have a 16-year-old daughter who, of course, texts and emails, and she loves that most of her male friends in particular use perfect grammar and punctuation in their texts.
Wow.
She just is so proud of that.
Yeah, does she report that, or have you read these texts, and can you verify that these 16-year-old boys are using perfect grammar?
Well, to be honest with you, I haven't verified it. We just had a conversation about grammar and punctuation, and she was bragging on her male friends that use perfect punctuation.
That's cool. That's encouraging. I'm happy to hear that.
Well, I also want to say I recently reread, I'm almost 50, and I recently reread a letter that I wrote to my grandmother when I was 15.
Right.
I was appalled.
Right.
At my grammar and punctuation at that age. And now I am perfectionist, you know. I want it to be, I even reread my emails before I send them out to make sure that what I mean cannot be misconstrued.
How did you learn? Where did you learn from 15 to now? What was the point at which you learned all this stuff?
I don't know if it's just a matter of maturity.
Right.
I did learn the technical part of it better when I homeschooled my daughter about 5 years ago for 5 years from second to seventh grade. So I got it all over again. And so I'm very, very confident now
right.
when I'm writing.
I bet you read a lot also.
Yes.
Right. And that to me is the most important thing. But absolutely, yeah, teaching that when I started teaching 20 years ago and I had to actually think about these things that I had been a professional writer, but I had to think about it in a new way, that really did bring me to a new understanding. And that's actually this book that's coming out, How to Not Write Bad, really is based on my observations of the particular problems that I see most often in my students. And it's really not a huge number of things, and it's interestingly different from the things that are most often pointed out, but it just grew out of the classroom and observing those things and thinking about those things and putting them together in a book. So that rings true to me about the homeschooling thing.
Now, Teresa, I want to ask you about one thing before you go. I can tell that you're the parent of a teenager because you said that your daughter was bragging on her friend who was a guy instead of bragging about. Now, that's a new usage, isn't it?
Oh, it is not. No,
it's
if I
not?
May jump in. No, that's
yeah.
regionalism. And, you know, do you have any Southerners in your family?
Mm-mm.
Okay. Teresa, not Veronica.
All right. Teresa, do you?
More, I do, but not that would have influenced me.
Or that you know of. But anyway, that's a long-standing regionalism, bragging on instead of bragging about. You know, if you look up in the Dictionary of American Regional English, you'd find uses of it back in the 19th century.
And I would say that probably comes from the reading that I do.
Okay, yeah,
because
like
I've
Mark
heard
Twain.
In the reading that I've
sure.
done.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting because I feel like I've heard that more on teenagers on TV, from teenagers on TV.
But that could be. I mean, one of the things about today's environment is that these things move and change so quickly. So, you know, hip hop language of like urban black rappers has spread through youth all over the country and then filtered on up to older people. All these different kinds of lingo that used to be kept in just a narrow circle have spread. I mean, a colleague of mine or a friend of mine who also writes about language, Ben Zimmer, just did a post today about how politicians are now always talking about doubling down.
Right,
and
yeah.
All in. And he traces how this came from, you know, Texas Hold'em poker that's on TV all the time. And it's, you know, it's very colorful, vivid metaphors, and so it just spreads. And you see the same thing from sports talk, computer talk, business talk, hip hop talk, et cetera. So it's a very fast moving language world nowadays.
Yeah. So Texas Hold'em poker. That's interesting. I was wondering about that one. Actually,
I think the all in is from poker. The doubling down, I think, is from blackjack.
From blackjack.
I'm not a gambler, but that's my understanding.
Okay. Well, Teresa, thanks so much for your call. And we go next let's do an email next because we've got several of those. This is from Trish, who says, many years ago when I was following in my older brother's footsteps with regard to copious cursing, my father told me that cuss words were most effective when used sparingly. The same can be said for exclamation marks.
Absolutely. I think whoever told her that had a lot was wise. And I also like her use of alliteration in was copious cussing or copious
cursing.
Very
right.
good, yeah. And, you know, my wife loves to watch Jon Stewart, and I certainly think he's a very talented guy, but I think he goes to that particular well too often, in my opinion. And of course, his cusses are bleeped, but you can read his lips and know exactly what he's saying. And I think among comedians, that's considered a kind of a cheap laugh. And I think that really is true. So use sparingly and strategically is the way to go.
You need to write him a letter, Ben.
Oh, yes, exactly. That's
as a language professor.
Top of my agenda, yeah.
All right, another email here from Mike in Madison. He says that emails that he feels he is unable to write to people without emoticons, like smiley face and wink, and he feels very little substantive discussion is taking place because people would sooner alienate you or unfriend you than debate ideas without exclamation points. And it seems to me, as you know, I email a lot, like everybody does, that the emoticons went out for a long time, right, and they become something embarrassing, and that now they're back in. Have you noticed that?
I have not. My sense is that, as you said, that people sort of discover them and say, hey, this is cool, and there's 1,700 different ones you could use. Then there was a bit of a backlash, properly so, in my opinion. And I guess my sense of it since then is it not that it's so much come back, but that it persists on kind of a low-level usage, that some people use them generally, in certain segments, I wouldn't hazard to say what segments they are, but I do run across them sometime, I guess, more young than old, but I don't see them very much, and I'm not a fan. I mean, I guess I feel like, well, you know, we've got these punctuation marks that we can use. We've got language. We've got irony. We've got lots of tools. You know, let's not go back to hieroglyphics. You know, many eons ago, our ancestors were using that. So I'm not a big fan, and I don't see a especially widespread use of them now.
But they look so much cuter now on people's iPhones than when you had to do them with your parentheses and your colons.
Right, right. And, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll come up with a new hieroglyphic language where we can have pictures for everything we want to communicate. That would be an interesting phenomenon, too.
All right, let's take another call. Anne with us in Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hello. So I'm not in the literary or English field whatsoever, but I am in a profession. I'm a physician, and we write without copy editing all the time.
Right.
So it's kind of an interesting predecessor to electronic communications, I think. But one of my questions is on the subjunctive. So the subjunctive has been misused forever, and my mother recently told, who's just fanatic in terms of grammar, told me that it's been okay to misuse the subjunctive. Mm. And I was wondering if that's true, and if it's not, has the subjunctive been completely killed by electronics as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you use a lot of terms in there, like, is it okay to misuse, and those are loaded terms. You know, if something is okay, who is the person deciding if it's okay?
Well, wait, first give us a refresher on the subjunctive.
Well, I guess by example, the most common form of the subjunctive, and I think what you and your mother might be referring to, is saying, if I were president, I would abolish the income tax. That the were is subjunctive, rather than saying, if I was president, I would banish the income tax. Is that what you're referring to?
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm referring to. And it's not just in non-copy edited items either. It's also, this is misused in books by good authors. I think I've caught Ann Patchett misusing the subjunctive.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, you keep using that misusing again, and I don't know, that's my non-stickler hat I'm putting back on again. And yeah, I mean, things change over time, and everyone acknowledges that. I think the disagreement is to how fast the change should be, so that when I was a kid, and I won't say how long ago that was, I learned we didn't have middle school, we had junior high school, that for the future tense, you say, I shall go to the movies tomorrow. And if you said, I will go to the movies, you were misusing the future tense.
Right.
Now, if I were to announce to my family, I shall go to the movies tomorrow, they would look at me like I was a nitwit and dingbat, and properly so, because that particular use that was very common in the late 19th and early 20th century and continued and lingered on up to the 1960s when I gave it away when I was in junior high school, by now has just gone by the boards. And so this, if I were, if I was, is in a much earlier stage of change. But yeah, you do see it that it's that form of the subjunctive is sometimes used, and it's sometimes not used, or if you want to call it misused. But I referred to the New York Times and Associated Press and New Yorker that have their copy books and style books that say how they how their language should operate. All of those would say use the were, and sometimes it slips by, but those official sources still would have the were there. And of course, then they run into the question of if they're quoting somebody and they say the quote unquote wrong way, do you quote them? And reporters would say yes, absolutely, you can't change change the quote. So if you read the New York Times, some of these usages, the quote wrong form and the correct form are both in the paper. The correct form from the pen of the authors and reporters, the wrong form from the sources that they quote.
Well, our guest this hour is Ben Yagoda. He's a professor of English, journalism, and writing at the University of Delaware. He has a blog on writing at the New York Times, and it's called Draft. And we're wondering about the ways that online communication has changed the way that we write in print, and also just looking at some of the conventions that have sprung up around online texting and tweeting and email and formats like that. And we're interested to hear your questions, your pet peeves, at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, and our email is talk@wpr.org. You can also chime in on Facebook at The Veronica Rickert Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 2 o'clock, join us for a Talk of the Nation. We know that microbes are good for your gut, but did you know that they keep your nose healthy, too? On Science Friday, Talk of the Nation, we look at the bacterial gardens inside us. Plus, think you can tell when a politician dodges a question? Well, take a look at that at 2 o'clock, Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Veronica Rickert with you this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we take a look at language and how online communication has changed the way that we write in print and just the different styles that have sprung up around the way that we communicate online as well. Our guest is Ben Yagoda, and he has a forthcoming book. It is called How to Not Write Bad. He's also a professor of English, journalism, and writing at the University of Delaware. And an email here from Jeanette in Milwaukee, who says, having been taught to be succinct, I shudder when I hear absolutely, certainly, or exactly instead of yes. Instead of good, I hear awesome, amazing, stupendous. And she wants to know, Ben, your thoughts on superlative expressions.
Well, I know where she's coming from, and I feel similarly. You know, it's interesting, when I heard the beginning of her email, I thought she was going to talk about the thing that's really my pet peeve, which is too many words. You know, the famous book, Elements of Style by Strunk and White, has that watchword, omit needless words. And, you know, in I mentioned my book, How to Not Write Bad, is springs from the problems and mistakes I see in my students' writing. And that's probably the number one problem I see is wordiness. In terms of long words instead of short words, I sympathize with that as well. The superlative thing, that relates to me to the exclamation point issue we talked about earlier, that it's this inflation. So yes or good is not enough. It's a little bit like the story of the boy who cried wolf. He'd say, yes, absolutely. And instead of saying, with an understanding that you're speaking the truth and not having to say anything, you have to say, sincerely, I really mean it. This is absolutely true. So I do sympathize with that there's a inflation of superlatives as well. I think she's on the mark there.
You don't think as a writer it's just more interesting to hear different words instead of yes and good all the time?
Oh, I do. I do as well. And there are some awesome words. There are some awesome long words like eschew and deviate, and just great, great words that for which there's no substitute. And you are right that repeating the same words a lot, it can be boring. But I find my students, one example I always think of is they're writing an essay or an article, and they're saying, John Smith resides in Newark, Delaware. And the resides really hurts me because it just means lives. It means nothing different from lives, but it's just a fancier, longer, duller, more pretentious word.
It causes you physical pain.
It does. It does. almost. It distresses me, which is another good word. That's a three-syllable word. So I love long and even unusual and uncommon words, precisely used. I am a huge fan of that. But long, fancy words needlessly used, or even worse, incorrectly used, as they often are, that those distress me.
So just as a sidebar, the word is pronounced eschew? I always said
eschew.
Well,
I don't know.
Okay, you don't know.
Right, more than here, but I think so.
I say eschew.
Eschew.
But I don't know. Eschew. Maybe our producer will look it up for us.
Sounds like something you put on a foot is eschew.
Yeah, that's true. It does sound like that. I don't know. Hopefully someone will call in or Marika will find out for us. All right, let's go to our next caller, Rosie in Wausau. Hi, Rosie.
Hi there. I wondered if your guest could speak to this phenomenon that I find very physically cringe myself when I hear someone speaking and they precede their statement or answer to a question with the word so. And then they go on, and forgive me, I'm a huge fan of NPR, and today on Science Friday,
right,
where I hear the most intelligent people, scientists and engineers and, you know, very educated people, consistently using the word so. And my question to you was also, I find this creeping into emails that I'm getting now, people that literally, their email starts out with so, and then blah, blah.
Yeah.
So if you could speak to that, and I'd give anything to make that stop.
Yeah, we can't make it stop. Sorry, it's too late. Can't put the genie back in the bottle. But it is absolutely a phenomenon. I've written about it. I contribute to a blog at the Chronicle of Higher Education, chronicle.com website. It's the publication of academia called Lingua Franca that the five of us write about language. And I've written about that so, that sentence starting so. I initially became aware of it. I had a sort of general vague sense of it, but there was a brilliant article in the New York Times about it about 2 years ago. And this writer, whose name I forget, traced it to Silicon Valley, actually. And there was somebody in Microsoft who claimed to have started that trend. And you're absolutely right that on NPR, and especially among scientists, computer scientists, and it's spread out to the rest of the population, it is an epidemic. And, you know, once you start noticing it, you'll find it unavoidable. Nothing can be done about it. Nothing can be done about any of these things. They are just something that one observes, and you make your own choices about what you want to do, but you cannot stop it, fortunately or unfortunately.
I think of that one as just the way that people talk right now. And I remember when I read Zadie Smith's novel on beauty, she uses it all over the place. And sometimes, she was the first novelist I'd seen do this, she would just have the word so in a bit of dialogue and dot, dot, dot. And at first it seemed strange, but then I thought, no, that's exactly how people talk.
Well, you know what? That's a little bit, I think, a little bit of different so. There's long been, the word's long been used. In fact, I think the poem Beowulf in some translations starts with the word so. It's, to oversimplify, it's traditionally been used to ask a question. So what do you want to do tonight, Marty? So do you think this will work? Or just so, dot, dot, dot. That's different. This new thing, as the caller pointed out, is answering a question. And I think of it sometimes as the phrase, it turns out that is implied but missing. So it turns out that there's this new discovery, like you're bringing the listener into the middle of the conversation, to the middle of the sequence. It's a very subtle thing. But it's absolutely happening. I think the novelist Jonathan Franzen was quoted in an article I read about the phenomenon as in one of his novels, a character discusses that. I have not looked that up yet. But it's a new, very widespread thing.
Interesting. Okay, I've been schooled on the word so. And now it's my turn. So it is pronounced eschew.
Ah, okay, good.
Now we know.
Now I know.
Anyway, that one seems like it's got about three too many consonants. It's hard to figure out how you pronounce
it. It's hard to say, yeah.
All right, Mike is our next caller. Mike from Crawford County. Hi, Mike.
Yes, good morning. I have an interesting dilemma. If the professor can solve it, I'll salute him.
Okay.
The example is basically, people speak, it's kind of a cross between diction and vernacular. They speak one way, and then on the computer, or in script, they may use proper punctuation, but when they speak, they don't. And an example of this would be a professor that originally came up with Away with Words that used to be aired, I think it still is, on Sunday morning.
Okay.
And he referred to this as upspeaking.
Oh, yeah.
Everything they say, they end it in a question, why, and rather than making a statement. Now, this is a national epidemic. They used to do this in the southern states a little bit, and it was natural down there, but now it's up here. The parents, the kids come home, they talk this way, the parents, it rubs off on the parents.
Right.
It stays in the family, and then when they mature, they think, well, this is a natural way
right.
to talk, and I don't get it. It's stupid. It's idiotic. I can't stand it.
Right. Tell me what you really think, though. No, you're right. I mean, it's a phenomenon often called up-talk or up-speak, and it's been mocked for decades and decades. I mean, my name is and it's often associated more with females than with males. I just did it. I don't know. I think studies have shown it. If you look at a book like Deborah Tannen's work on the language differences between men and women, I'm sure she gets into that. And I think it is the case that it's more commonly used by females and young females. You know, it's sometimes been interpreted as those speakers not being sure of themselves and being timid and related to sexism or whatever that was. I think there have been other interpretations saying, hell no, we're not timid. We talk that way because that's the way we want to talk. So, if you look into the literature and scholarship about that, there are dozens, probably hundreds of studies of uptalk over the years. So, again, as with the previous thing, we can bemoan it. We can criticize it, but unfortunately we're not going to do anything about it. And you know, if you find yourself in a conversation with someone who speaks that way and you don't like it, and you say, I don't like that stupid way you're talking, I don't think that's going to do that's going to have the desired effect either. So it's just one of those things. To use another cliche, it is what it is.
Sorry, Mike, take a couple aspirin,
Mike.
I guess. Let's see. I think maybe one or two more calls. Let's go to Lauren joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. My comment, I actually wanted to disagree with your guest on his statement that reside means the same as the word live. I'm an attorney, that we in law school we were taught to be very, very exact with the words that we use. And I guess to me, reside, you can reside somewhere without living there. Like, say you have a house and you know, multiple places, and you might sleep there every once in a while, but you don't actually live there.
Right.
So, you know, and it's just different words have, you know, there's different words for different, you know, for a reason. And there's, you know, I've also was taught in law school to use instead of the word as, you know, to use the word because it's more forceful.
Right.
So different. I mean, I guess in a legal sense, different words can have different meanings.
I point taken, and I see your point. I will say that my students are not attorneys or lawyers, so that they're not aware of those things that you're talking about. But I definitely can understand that there's a difference, and thank you for pointing it out.
All right, maybe one more super quick call. Linda in Middleton.
Hi, my eighth grade son asked me this the other day. He wanted to know if this is a double negative, so I thought this would be a good question for you.
Oh, boy.
His teacher said, I can't not tell you the truth. And he was wondering if that is a double negative.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it is a double negative because you have cannot not tell you, but it's not a double negative in the sense of anything wrong with it. You know, the double negatives that are called wrongers are things like the Rolling Stones, I can't get no satisfaction, where we would say, you should say, I cannot get any satisfaction. And how many records would that sell?
Right.
But I cannot not tell the truth might be the teacher's way of saying, I am
physically incapable of telling anything but the truth. So it is a double negative, but there's nothing wrong per se with double negatives.
All right. Thank you, Linda. And Ben, we're out of time, but when is your book due out? Is it February?
It is indeed February. Riverhead Press, and information you can find on my own website, benyagoda.com. And I have a bunch of excerpts from there from the book as
Excellent.
Well.
Excellent. We're looking forward to it. Thank you
Good.
So much for joining us this hour.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
Ben Yagoda, professor of English, journalism, and writing at the University of Delaware. He contributes to Lingua Franca, Chronicle of Higher Education blog about language and writing, and also Draft, a New York Times blog. His forthcoming book is called How to Not Write Bad. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this one and to Marika Suval for on-air production. I'm Veronica Rickert, wishing you a great weekend on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. Our show speaks for itself, but you don't have to take my word for it.
I love your show.
I have listened to you for years.
Obviously, the 2 hours I look forward to all week long are Science Friday hours.
That's Talk of the Nation's Science Friday from NPR News.